It is 8:31. We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Tons to cover this morning, so let us begin. Starting with hopeful for Governor Mr. Dino Rossi.
We shouldn't laugh until we actually talk about what we're laughing about.
Yes, yes. Dino Rossi, was it about a month ago when he
Okay, came, can I start laughing now?
When he came out and made his statement about how he was for a downtown traffic tunnel to replace the Alaskan Way Viaduct.
Yeah, he had a comprehensive transportation plan, and many parts of it were patently ludicrous.
Yeah, and the one that reporters first focused on was the downtown traffic tunnel to replace the Alaskan Way Viaduct after voters had already rejected a downtown traffic tunnel. Now Rossi's,
overwhelmingly.
Yeah, now Rossi is pushing his idea of replacing the 520 bridge with an 8-lane span. This is after neighborhood groups and local politicians and state legislators have all already approved and agreed upon a 6-lane span.
Yeah, a process that took about approximately 2 years of negotiation, and also after the State Department of Transportation Planning categorically rejected an 8-lane proposal for 520 bridge as being patently unworkable because both I-5 and I-405 can't handle the traffic.
Yeah, and Rossi, I think probably the most absurd thing is that Rossi says that an 8-lane span will only cost about $3.3 billion. That's where the real ridiculousness of this comes in, because if you want to talk about how you're going to connect an 8-lane bridge to 405 and I-5, that in itself, just building the connectors, is going to cost about $3 billion. But it just goes to show that, you know, Rossi is trying to do anything and everything he can to get some kind of attention in this race, and making these absurd statements about highway construction he's hoping is going to draw him some attention.
Yeah, this is not a serious transportation proposal. It is meant as a political talking point so that Ross can claim he has a plan, some plan, any plan, and he uses it then as a platform to criticize Christine Gregoire because there's traffic gridlock in Seattle. Well, unfortunately, somebody forgot to write Dino Rossi the memo that says traffic is actually down in the Seattle area over what it was 6 months ago, a year ago, 2 years ago, because of the higher cost of gasoline. People are driving less, they're taking fewer unnecessary trips, and so state transportation planners are starting to shift their attention away from expanding lane capacity and highway construction and into public transit, which is where the real demand is right now. Somebody forgot to tell Dino Rossi, who still seems stuck in 1950s Chamber of Commerce mode.
Yeah, well, he's taking money from big business developers.
Well, and the asphalt lobby.
Yes, the asphalt lobby, the east side lobby that believes in highways uber alles. So.
All right, moving on. The Seattle Times and Weyerhaeuser.
Yeah, the Seattle Times discovered this week that the state's Department of Natural Resources is a subsidiary of Weyerhaeuser in the way that they function.
And not even a very efficient subsidiary of Weyerhaeuser either, seeing as how they don't do a very good job of protecting Weyerhaeuser's long-term interests.
Yeah, that is a follow-up to the Seattle Times reporting on the flooding in Chehalis and Lewis County last year. They've been looking at problems with landslides, particularly due to clear cuts on steep slopes. And what they're finding is that the way Weyerhaeuser gets approval from the state's Department of Natural Resources to clear cut steep hillsides is as follows. The DNR allows Weyerhaeuser to use its own hired geologists to do site surveys and file a geologist report with the state's Department of Natural Resources. And then the Department of Natural Resources rubber stamps it, files it, and forgets about it. They never seem to follow up on any of Weyerhaeuser's own reports on their geological surveys, even when the Department of Natural Resources already has information on file that says that these lands are at risk for a landslide. So it's interesting. This is something that environmentalists have been saying for years, if not decades. And it's interesting that the Seattle Times has finally discovered this.
right.
Yeah, and as if to make up for the fact that they that in an election year, the Commissioner of Public Lands, Doug Sutherland, the two-term Republican who oversees the Department of Natural Resources and has basically been a shill for timber and mining industries his entire term in office.
Yeah, and he gets very positive press, even in so-called liberal Seattle.
Well, we saw some of that positive press this week when the blog Horse's Ass reported with documents that the Times, the PI, the Tacoma News Tribune, and the Olympian had all been sitting on the public records. Records show that they'd made the public records request of the relevant documents 3 or 4 months ago in all of these cases. This is a case dating back to 2005 where Doug Sutherland, on two separate occasions, rubbed his hand over the body, you know, groped and made sexually suggestive comments regarding a brand new, by all accounts, attractive young female, very junior woman in the department who he was introduced to. She was humiliated. She quit 2 weeks later. This was investigated. Several witnesses collaborated the young woman's accounts. Sutherland admitted to the behavior. Unlike the written policies of the department, he was never reprimanded for the incident. And the various media organs, the newspapers in this state, wouldn't report on the incident. Well, the Seattle Times finally comes out this week after a blog had to report the story, and the headline is Sutherland apologizes for sexual incident, as though the story were the apology rather than the actual incident itself. So this, again, an example of our allegedly fair and unbiased mainstream media really making excuses for inexcusable behavior on the part of an elected official. And you have to ask yourself why, particularly since that same elected official is in the middle of a very heated re-election battle against Peter Goldmark, and the same elected official is under fire for incompetence and cronyism when it comes to decisions that, by all accounts, were instrumental in leading toward the floods in Lewis County last December.
Massive destruction.
Yeah, where, you know, the running joke is, well, you know, every time something like this happens, the Department of Natural Resources blames it on an act of God. Well, you can at least start planning for these very regular acts of God.
Yeah. Well, and the State Department of Transportation is doing that. In fact, in Monday's Seattle Times, they did a follow-up article how on the State Department of Transportation has to do the Department of Natural Resources job by going after Weyerhaeuser when they put in applications to log steep hillsides that overlook state highways, because during the flooding in Lewis County last year, a lot of state highways were damaged when steep hillsides gave way and there were avalanches that had to be cleared, and it's the Department of Transportation that has to pay for that and has to do the work. And they're pretty mad about that.
Yeah, if you take Highway 6 between PL and Chehalis, you can actually still see a lot of the damage from those floods even 8 months later.
Yeah.
All right, moving on. A big medical marijuana bust this week.
Yeah, in the University District on Tuesday, cops essentially took a complaint by a neighboring business a businesswoman that she could smell marijuana in the building as an excuse to bust a private collective of medical marijuana patients who have been prescribed medical marijuana by their doctors and who have gotten together and tried to figure out the vague laws in the state that allow medical marijuana and try to secure an adequate supply for their co-op members. Police went into the building. A bicycle cop said he also smelled pot, so they used that as an excuse to bust into the co-op's offices, steal the records of 500 patients, the confidential medical records of 500
yeah.
patients,
and when we talk
and
about
a laptop computer, and then break down a wall in the office because ostensibly they thought there was a secret growing operation there,
yeah,
which turned out not to exist.
As though you can't walk around to the other side of the building and see whether there's any space between, you know, say
the wall
and, oh, say a closet or the adjoining office.
Yeah.
When we talk about it as an excuse or as a pretext for this kind of action, bear in mind that this is a very well-established medical medical marijuana operation that was known to the city, that was known to the police department. They knew exactly what was going on in that building. And they'd been looking for a pretext for getting their hands on, apparently, on the records of the medical marijuana patients, which they did. Even though, by initiative in the city of Seattle, marijuana is supposed to be the lowest law enforcement priority for SPD. And even though SPD has, up until now, taken a very hands-off attitude toward both marijuana enforcement and medical marijuana, you have to wonder whether, number one, this is a reflection of the new Republican King County prosecuting attorney, Dan Satterberg, who was elected after he was appointed to office by the death of Norm Mailing. He was elected last November.
Whether this
is a reflection of changes of priority in that office, or what exactly is going on, because these sorts of raids do not happen by accident.
Mm-hmm. And it is clear, and the way it was done is clearly meant to be intimidation.
All right. Seattle Ethics and Election Commission.
Yeah, proving once again that the watchdog can, when aroused, when to righteous fury, gum its master to death. The Seattle Ethics and Election Commission fined City Councilman Richard McIver all of $1,000 for his awarding a no-bid contract to the firm of a friend of his just days after he returned from a vacation in that friend's Virgin Islands condo, a vacation which, by the way, was worth way more than $1,000. So, personally, he got a pretty good vacation out of the deal. For the $100,000 plus that city councilmen pay or get paid, $1,000 is really kind of a drop in the bucket or a slap on the wrist in terms of a fine. And, of course, McIver himself is still denying that he did anything wrong. In fact, the direct quote, he doesn't believe he did anything wrong. That was in the PI this week, and the Times had a similar quote. Richard McIver's term is up next year after this and the complaint that was initially filed against him by his wife for sexual abuse last year. It's very unlikely that McIver is going to run for re-election. He's probably going to retire. So the question then becomes, well, if he's a lame duck and he's going to retire and he's getting fined a pittance for these no-bid contract awards, what's to prevent him from doing this again and again and again? Which raises another interesting question that the city council moved the $73 million Pike Place market levy to the November ballot. Assuming the levy is approved in November, what again prevents the city council or an agency from taking any kind of major expenditures like that and again awarding them in contracts to their friends? Because there doesn't seem to be any kind of accountability built in within the system at this point. It's very troubling. As for that November ballot measure, bear in mind that Sound Transit is hoping to put a measure on the ballot in November for expansion of light rail. This before the first light rail line is open, so people haven't seen what it can possibly do. There's the potential for a parks levy that's going to go on the November ballot. There are several different money issues that are going to be on the November ballot. This at a time when the economy is downturning, when gas is $4.50 a gallon, food is costing a lot of money. People are going to be very tight with what they're willing to tax themselves in November, and all of these measures are going to have a tough time passing at the ballot box.
All right, moving on. The Seattle University coming out with the Seattle University Law School coming out with a report.
Yeah, the Seattle University Law School's Human Rights Clinic co-authored a report that was issued this week that alleges mistreatment of immigrant detainees at the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma. Now, that detention center is run by a private contractor based in Boca Raton, Florida. The private contractor is called the GEO Group. And SU grad students who conducted 46 interviews in 2007 and 2008 of detainees and their lawyers and family members noted several different problems, including the use of excessive strip searches, which can often be used as a form of punishment. They noted overcrowding in the facility, lack of medical care, not just inadequate medical care, but lack of medical care in many instances. Poor food. They noticed problems with the heating and the cooling systems in the building, lack of clean clothing and inadequate hygiene, and that detainees were often threatened or intimidated to try to get them to sign papers that they either didn't want to sign or that they didn't understand. And that many of them were also mistreated by guards and federal marshals. So it's worth saying over and over again that just because a person has broken one law related to immigration is no reason and no excuse to lock them up and treat them worse than you would treat an animal.
All right. Moving on, the State Human Rights Commission.
Yeah, the State Human Rights Commission is investigating the State Criminal Justice Training Commission. The Criminal Justice Training Commission runs a Corrections Officer Academy, and it turns out that they fired an officer for blowing the whistle on two other officers who were training candidates in what were termed brutal techniques and ways to sexually harass prisoners, as well as for sexually harassing some of the trainees in the program. Instead of firing the two officers who not only were alleged to have committed caused these problems, but who also through an internal audit by the Justice Training Commission were found to have also had these same complaints filed against them. Not only did they not fire those two officers, they fired the guy who blew the whistle on them. So I think that's showing a clear problem with the way that not just the city of Seattle has problems with oversight of its police officers, but the state also has problems with oversight of its corrections officers training program as well.
Briefly, you mentioned it, Seattle police officers.
Yeah, and this week we saw the third settlement for six figures against a police officer for police brutality this year alone. I think in the case there were two very interesting things about that. Let me see if I can find my notes here. I'm having trouble finding my notes. But one of the things that I found very interesting on that is the officer involved in the police brutality case that was settled this week had been investigated by the OPA, and the OPA had recommended that this guy be disciplined. Well, the department decided not to discipline him. They just referred him for additional training. And this is a guy who has had, I think, more than 50 complaints issued against him for police brutality since what the department calls use of excessive force. That's the new euphemism.
Sounds like he was already pretty well trained.
Yeah, and that's just since he joined the department in 2001.
All right. So, moving on to national and the Fourth Circuit Court in Virginia.
Yeah, this by far the most conservative of the various circuit court of appeals had a 5-4 ruling this week that was very disturbing in its implications. It upheld the indefinite detention of U.S. citizens as enemy combatants. Now, it was reported in many media accounts as a mixed decision because it also said that those citizens, if they were named as enemy combatants by the President of the United States, they could be detained indefinitely or they could be imprisoned indefinitely. Let's not use the euphemism of detainees anymore, shall we? But they did have to have due process. But what exactly does due process mean? In this case, the defendant is a guy named Ali Al-Mari. He's a legal U.S. resident from Qatar. He's been held since the Muslim sweeps post 9/11 in 2001, was charged in 2002 with credit card fraud, and in 2003 was named an enemy combatant based on second and third hand torture induced accounts by somebody somewhere. The government still has not said where. The claim that Al-Mari was came to the United States to be part of an Al-Qaeda sleeper cell. Well, the definition of a sleeper cell cell is that his big offense was that he slept. In other words, he didn't do anything. So what does it mean to have due process when, as we've talked about on this program before, one of the whole points of torture isn't that it induces bad information to be elicited from prisoners, but the whole point is that you can get them to tell you what you want them to tell you, and therefore you then have a narrative that fits with your preconceived idea of what you want to have. In other words, if you want somebody to testify that this guy is a bad actor, you can get anybody to testify that this guy is a bad actor. You just torture them enough. So what does it mean to have due process saying that you go to a court and say, yes, we've got a witness, we can't produce the witness, we can't name exactly what the witness said, but we can assure you that in fact this guy is a bad actor, and the court says okay and signs off on it. That is not due process. There was also no time window that was specified on this. So a very, very troubling decision. It means that, for example, President Obama could come in and say that you, Maria, you are an enemy combatant because you didn't vote for President Obama, and therefore you can be whisked off and held indefinitely in a military brig somewhere without trial.
Yeah.
All right, moving on, this week's economic news.
Yeah, there were two big things in the economic news this week. First was the collapse of IndyMac Bank, a Southern California regional bank that was seized by the feds last Friday after customers made a run on the bank trying to withdraw their money. This is the largest bank failure since the S&L scandal in the 1980s. It's the third biggest bank failure in U.S. history. The only two larger ones were in the 1980s during the S&L scandal. The FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, will have to cough up between $4 to $8 billion in order to cover depositors' assets. And that still leaves about 20,000 people who will lose at least part of what they deposited in the bank. This was also the interesting thing about IndyMac is that it was the ninth largest mortgage lender in the U.S. with some $32 billion of assets. So even with that kind of capitalization, this bank was not too big to fail. And it really sort of asks the question, what is too big to fail? What is small enough that the feds will just let it go under? And what does that mean for consumers, for people who have their money deposited in not big banks, but smaller regional banks? And can we really know what is a big versus a small bank when a company like Washington Mutual, for example, is national in the sense that it's the third largest mortgage lending company in America, and yet it's regional in that it's commercial deposits and its private banking is not as nearly as large as its mortgage lending unit. So it leaves people who have deposits at Washington Mutual wondering, could the same thing happen to them? Well, we don't really know, do we? Because there's not nearly enough transparency in the financial sector. Well, this question of what is too big to fail is interesting because it hits on the other big economic news this week, which was the Fed propping up Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, basically giving them a bailout, saying, okay, here's $300 billion that you can draw on to avoid going under. Because this past week, shares of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac fell by almost 50%. And the problem with letting companies as big as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac go under is that these are truly mammoth banks, and they really are key in not just the U.S. financial industry, but the global financial industry. Particularly, I mean, before Congress approved the expansion of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to pretty much take over mortgage lending, because now they constitute something like 98% of the market for mortgage lending in the U.S. now, as of March, from about March to June. But Congress had to approve an expansion allowing them to borrow more in order to lend more. Well, to borrow more, they had to go to other banks to borrow the money, which means they owe money to all these other banks, not just in the U.S., but all over the world, particularly Asian banks who saw Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac as a very safe investment. Well, well, it's Asia that global economists are looking to help bail us out of our current problem. Well, Asian banks are suffering too now. So really, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are too big to let them go under. But it's really points at how bad the whole problem is if here at the start of the credit crisis, we're seeing this happen now.
Yeah, it's going to get worse before it gets better.
All right, just a couple minutes left. Moving on to international and Iran.
Yeah, some positive developments for a change this past week or two in negotiations with Iran over its nuclear program, the 5+1 negotiations. There was a secret letter that was drafted on June 14th in which the U.S. Expressed its willingness for the first time to negotiate around uranium enrichment and some of the other issues directly with Iran. Now came the announcement this week that Nicholas Burns, who testified last week before Congress that he was going to work very hard toward a diplomatic solution, some people took that as a positive sign. Other people thought, well, the Bush administration has made paid lip service to diplomacy before. Well, he is actually going to participate in the talks for the first time. The Bush administration will actually sit down and talk with Iran on the nuclear issue. That cannot help but be a positive development.
All right. And Iraq.
Yeah, we saw a bunch of reports this morning that both al-Maliki's government in Baghdad and the United States in the White House had reported that the security agreement that's being negotiated between the two governments had agreed in principle to something called a time horizon rather than the troop withdrawal deadline that the Iraqis had demanded. Now, this is being spun by the Washington Post and New York Times this morning as major shift for the Bush administration. They've agreed to a timeline for withdrawal. Not hardly. It's giving both sides something that they can point to and claim they got what they wanted. The Iraqi government is saying, well, the Bush administration agreed to something. The Bush administration can say, well, we didn't agree to a timeline for withdrawal. And it's neither really not clear what either side of them means. But the critics within Iraq and the critics of the war are still going to be saying, look, this doesn't actually commit the Bush administration or the successor government, whether it's Obama or McCain, to actually doing anything in terms of withdrawing troops from Iraq.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This State. And where do people find Eat This State?
We are in the middle of a fund drive for Eat This State. It's a volunteer publication that comes out every couple of weeks and can be found around town as a newspaper in bookstores, cafes, libraries, places where you find free periodicals. You can also find it on the web at www.eatthestate.org. We are dependent on small business advertising, subscriptions, and especially reader donations for our support, so we appreciate your help. There's a PayPal button on the site, again, www.eatthestate.org. And if you'd like to write something for us or volunteer, or you'd like to offer feedback for anything you hear on the program, you can give our voicemail a call at 206-719-6947 or email us at info@eatthestate.org.